Hi, this is Dr. Linda Papadopoulos with The Psychology Behind. Now, on today's show, I get to speak to the lovely Gail Porter. Now, you will know Gail from her. She presented Top of the Pops for 5 years. She's been on our screens for easily 20 years. She's been very open about her own struggles with mental health. And in the podcast, I think we spoke about some really interesting things. We spoke about what she's been through in terms of her alopecia and her own mental health struggles. But beyond that, we spoke quite a lot about her being a mom and what that gives you in terms of your identity. But I think also kind of that connection that we have with our kids being good for our own sort of sense of self, our own mental health, how they see what you want to see in yourself, I think, and kind of see through the BS that when you're a public figure, I think you don't often have. And she speaks very eloquently about that. So I had a great discussion with Gail Porter. Here it is. Hope you enjoy it. Gail, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. This is really nice. What a lovely, lovely Christmassy house this is.
Yeah, I think beautiful. I've overdone the Christmas stuff.
No, I love it. You can never overdo Christmas.
I think so. Gail, I remember the first time I remember seeing you was on the Ali G show with Sacha Baron Cohen. Do you remember this?
Do you know what? I remember because my mum came with me to do the Ali G show and we were in the green room and Sacha Baron Cohen came in the green room as Sacha Baron Cohen. And then he said to me, Gail, do you want to know what we're going to be doing on the Ali G show? And I said, absolutely not whatsoever, because it's the element of surprise. Yeah. It's also, it will make you laugh. And yeah. I like just not knowing what's happening, because I think if I'm laughing and it's going to make other people laugh. So my mum was enjoying the free wine. Oh, this is very nice. It's free wine. And then, so that was quite funny. And then so suddenly Sasha came back as Ali G, and my mum was, you know, about three wines in, going, oh, this is hilarious. And I was suddenly starting to panic, thinking, what's happening? So when he introduced me, yes, he did all these bits and pieces, and then I went in, and he was very flirty, and yeah. going, oh, it's, yeah, well, nice, isn't it? And all that kind of stuff. And then suddenly the lights started to dim, and he got me to sit on the sofa next to me, and then he started to sing every breath you take.
I remember that.
Every move you make. And I was sitting there thinking, no, make it stop, make it stop. And he just kept going and he didn't stop. He's going, every day you. And I was like, he's going to do the whole song. And he did the whole song. And I didn't know what to do with myself. But it was very, very funny. Yeah. And you know, things like that make me just love the fact that I have a bit of a different career.
Yeah.
And meet some people that are really funny. And like my mum was like, by the time I got back, I'm not entirely sure if she realised what was going on, because I think she was like hanging out with some dodgy MP and drinking more wine, as one does, while I'm being sung to by Ali G, which is really good fun.
So how did you get into the media, into presenting? How did it all start?
Well, what happened was I wanted to be, firstly, I wanted to be Princess Leia from Star Wars, but obviously, you know, Carrie Fisher got in there before me and I was about seven, so I don't think I would have got the role anyway. And then it just sort of got me really fascinated in films and television, because when I went to see Star Wars, I cried at the end of the film and my mum was like, right, come on, out the cinema. And I was like, I can't, I want to go to space. So I always had that kind of like, I just wanted to do something different. And then I went to film school, studied, because I wanted to be an editor or a producer. And I went to film school and studied. And then I started babysitting. I was a runner, you know, the usual sort of working in television, making teas for nothing and coffee for nothing and picking up people's dry cleaning, because apparently that's what you do when you work in television. And then one of the directors asked me to babysit. And so I was babysitting for him and his wee ones. And he said to me one day, he said, you know, you get on so well with the kids. They love you. We've got a new children's show on ITV. And we're looking for new presenters. He said, but there's thousands. But do you want to come along and audition? And I thought, well, why not? Yeah. Do you know what? You only live once. And I remember turning up and I was just in jeans and a black T-shirt. And all these wannabe presenters were in like fluorescent orange and, you know, that whack-a-day kind of thing. And I thought, I'll never get anywhere. And so I auditioned and then I got down to the final, and then I got the job. So I ended up being a children's TV presenter on ITV. So it kind of just sort of, it zigzagged its way. Yeah. So here was me thinking I was going to direct the next Star Wars. And then I ended up doing a totally interactive game show for kids age I think it was 10 to 12 or something. And I loved it. And it was great fun. And it was live.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was kind of like when you go in straight to the deep end, you've got no fear.
But the other thing, of course, that you're really well known for was, again, being beautiful. I remember so the Houses of Parliament, am I right? Were you like not projected onto the...
See, I still don't really understand what happened. Because when I was a kids' TV presenter, I'm just average next door looking girl. I don't look any different from anybody else. And I was doing all these little kiddie programs and stuff. Then I sort of evolved to Top of the Pops, which was great. And because that's like every kid's dream to suddenly go in, hello, it's still number one. Yeah. It's Top of the Pops. Not everyone does it in a Scottish accent, but I did. And then it was, I think it was GQ magazine sent me a message saying, you've got a bit of a dad fan base. Would you like to come and do a photo shoot with us? I thought, why not, you know?
Yeah.
And so it was a picture of me lying down and I was all coloured blue and my bottom was showing. And I thought, oh, and my mum was not best pleased. And then FHM called me up and said, could we just do, it's going to be a wee tiny thing. We're not going to pay you. It's probably going to be in like page 70 or something. Just sort of saying, you know, kids TV presenter has gone up to do Top of the Pops. Da, da, da. And I said, yeah, why not? So I did quite a few shots. My mum actually came with me and she's like, oh dear Gail, put some clothes on. And I was like, mum, they're never going to use it. No one's going to see it. And then
famous last words, right?
Mum, they're not paying me, so it's nothing's going to be big. It's like page 72. No one's going to see it. And then I got up one morning and I heard my name. I was brushing my teeth and I heard my name on BBC News. And I thought, right, I don't do anything newsworthy. So I started to panic a little bit, thinking, I don't know what's happened. So I went through and I saw this image of me on the Houses of Parliament, completely naked, 100 feet tall. And I was like, oh dear. And then the phone started to ring because I was thinking, this must be, is this a joke?
Yeah,
someone,
yeah.
You know, your mind is just going, has someone put a VHS in those days?
Yeah,
has someone put a VHS in? And it's like some sort of joke. My friends have popped in the night. And then I did that, you know, have you seen Notting Hill when Rhys Ifans opens the door in his pants? So I opened my curtains in my vest and shorts and there was paparazzi everywhere. And I thought, this is actually, I think this is real. And then my mum rang and she was like, what the beep? And I was like, sorry. And
it really is on page 72 and on the Houses of Parliament. It's
like, and on the front page and on six other pages inside as well. And you're not getting paid. And so I just phoned up the editor of FHM, Anthony, his name was at the time. And I was like, what the? And he's like, it's good though, eh? And I'm like, no, the entire country's seen me naked. I didn't mind page 72 with my bottom, but the Houses of Parliament, are you crazy? So it was very weird. And I kept thinking about what members of Parliament were actually in the building.
But also what different times now? Like, can you imagine that? Like, that, you know, I think people forget sort of, you know, women of our era with the whole lad mag thing and this idea that, you know, it was cool to be objectified and you had to laugh at being objectified. And whereas now, can you imagine anyone getting away with that? Like, not in...
No, exactly.
Whereas there you were supposed to be pleased that they'd done this. And isn't that
well,
interesting?
Well, I kind of found it empowering as well because I was a very strong girl and I was body confident and I didn't do anything gratuitous.
No.
But I just think, you don't even know. Is it she, man, he, man? Who even knows
completely.
Anymore?
It's gone the other way. But what I'm saying is they didn't ask and they did this. So to me, I find that interesting. I'm not saying, obviously, it was your decision.
Oh, yeah.
But the idea, like, you go from page 72 to projections, like, that's like a big...
And it was illegal. And it was like, so I've got to be really careful when I say this. It was a company called Cunning Stunts.
Well done.
I was very careful there, wasn't I? I'm really good there. So that's an illegal company. So what they would do is project images places. So from what I found out, once I'd actually calmed down and realised that the entire neighbourhood had seen me naked, and the postman going, all right, Gail, give me a wee wink. I was like, oh no, the postman. He was nice, but he was about 60. That's old, but you know, for me, it was just, I've known him for years. And then suddenly it's like your grandpa going, and actually my grandfather bought 4 copies of FHM. And he's like, hello, Gail, I'm not embarrassed at all because I saw you naked when you were a baby and you're my granddaughter and I've got 4 copies and Uncle Alf wants to say something on the phone. And I was like, oh my gosh, Uncle Alf, who's in his like 70s. And he's like, oh, Gail, that's impressive. And I was like, there's so many things wrong with this conversation and the fact you've got 4 copies on your table. But But yeah, no, it was a very, yeah. very weird thing.
Oh man, that's amazing. So, and that kind of continues like that. And then you actually have a huge blow because, you know, you say you're a girl next door. You're stunning. You've always been stunning. You're sitting here across from me. You are. But then
That's very kind, but no.
Well, yeah, that's what I see genuinely. But then the alopecia sets in when, Gil? When does that start? When does that kind of shift in your identity begin?
Well, it was a very odd one with the alopecia. And I was actually working in America. I was looking for dead people. So we that's what it does. Do you know, every time I say things out loud, I realise why I'm single and I stay at home. Because when you actually say what you did as a living and what's happened, you think, no, I love the cat because the cat can't answer me back. But I was in America, I was in Las Vegas, and we were doing this programme called Dead Famous. So we were working with psychics and doing voodoo and all that really fun things and trying to find dead famous people from Elvis to Frank Sinatra. And so we're in Vegas, I think we're looking for Frank Sinatra, and I was in a graveyard. It was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and I just, there was like, it'd been happening, there was a wee clumps coming out, but my daughter was only a year and a half or so, or two, I think, and so everyone said to me, you know, hormones change after you have a baby, so that's probably what it could be. So I thought, okay, I won't panic too much, and then it was literally coming out in like handfuls and handfuls, and then when we were filming, I went into the makeup, we had like a wee caravan thing, went in there, and the lady was looking at me and she said, are you okay? And we couldn't cover it up. It was so much had gone up. And she said to me, what do you want me to do about this? And I said, just shave it off. She's like, are you sure? And I said, look, I mean, there's nothing we can do. We can't even colour it in. It's just, there's like a strand here and a strand there. And I said, let's just do this. And I'm just going to have to like, you know, grin and bear it. Mm. And luckily the director was great, so we put headscarves on, so we sort of, you know, continuity, we kind of made it work. And then I phoned home, and my ex-husband was looking after my daughter, and I just phoned home and I said, oh, my hair's fallen out. And he was like, don't be ridiculous. And I said, no, it's all fallen out.
Because it was that quick. So this was over just a couple of weeks
couple of
filming.
Weeks, yeah.
It went, wow.
Yeah. And so it went from almost down to my waist to nothing at all. And so I cried the whole way home. And I remember, because I was flying Virgin, and all the staff were so lovely, literally like champagne, everything just to cut. I think they just wanted me to stop crying because I was in so much shock. And I wasn't that bothered about myself. I was worried about how Honey was going to react when she saw me. I remember seeing my dad turn up with a moustache once when I was little. I was thinking, oh God, you look really weird. So I thought, I'm going to turn up, you know, I've had a full head of hair, and then Mum's going to come home with nothing whatsoever. And she just looked at me, she's gone, cool.
Aww.
And that was it. And so as soon as she was fine, I was fine. And I thought, I am not going to wear a wig, and I'm going to take this on the chin. And I don't know anything about this. And if I can help other people, then I'm just going to rock it.
But that's what I absolutely found so just amazingly inspiring about you. We live in a world that's A, super visual, you know, B, I think, you know, women especially, you know, and men to a large extent, you know, our value, it's kind of a young age, it's the way that you look, you know, it's be beautiful, be young, be whatever, fill in the blank, thin, blonde, whatever it is. And you very much you were able to kind of maintain this identity where, you know, you didn't just hang your self-esteem on the looks, because you could have easily done the wigs very early on, but you, I remember you didn't, and you spoke about it, and there was such a, and I'm not suggesting it wasn't difficult, it must have been very difficult, but nevertheless, there was such a positivity. Where does that grit come from, Gail?
I know exactly, it's Honey, it's my daughter, so don't get me upset, because I'll cry. But she just looked at me, loved me, and I thought, do you know what? I don't really care what anyone else thinks. And my mum was going through cancer, and da-da-da. It was one thing after another. So I thought, do you know what? My hair is like the least of my worries. So, So I was sent lots of wigs, which was very kind of people, but I didn't want them. And then I gave them to my mum. So she loved them because she didn't want to be bald. And then I remember when she was going through the last part of her chemotherapy, and I said, Mum, take your wig off. I'm bald, you're bald, really, and Honey's here. And so we'd gone to a hotel somewhere because I was hosting an event, and my mum took the wig off, and Honey just went, you see, there's my grandma.
Oh,
and I was like, wow. And my mum just burst into tears, and I said, you know, I know that you want to wear it because it makes you feel better, but when you're with us, We don't care what you look like. So yeah, I just thought it was really important. And also, I've got quite a nice shaped head.
You do, that you do.
Yeah, I've got, there's a wee dent here, which my mum went, oh, that's where the forceps went in when we couldn't get you out, because you've been really awkward. You've always been awkward. So I've got a wee dent there. So she's like, yeah, but it's everything else, it's all right.
Tell me a bit about, honey, because literally, I wish this was TV. I wish we were filming this, because it's amazing. I always, when I listen to people talk, you literally light up every time you mention her name. I see your shoulders. Well, tell me a bit about your honey. What's your name?
Honey is just, just an amazing human being. She's not just my daughter. She's my best friend, and she's funny, and she'll put me in my place, and she'll tell me when I'm embarrassing. And she makes sure that I know that I can't sing, but I try, but I think I can sing. And it's really amazing, because you've got a 16-year-old, so you must probably feel the same as me, just watching them grow up.
Definitely.
And, you know, she's not had the easiest upbringing, because I've gone through my problems, which have been sort of documented, but her dad's been great, and, you know, we got divorced and da-da-da, and you know, she's come out, she's just kept solid, and she's just amazing. She's wonderful. Yeah. And she's still a bit kind of, someone sent me, because I didn't keep any of those magazines that I did when I was younger.
Yeah.
And someone sent me the original FHM. She's like, don't even open it. I don't want to see it. But she's very funny. She's got a great sense of humour. Yeah. She loves her music. And it's just amazing to... I was told I could never have children.
Really?
Yeah, because I was anorexic for a long time. So I hadn't eaten for... Well, I had obviously enough to keep me... But I hadn't, you know, I hadn't had periods or anything like that for about 10 years or something. And so the doctor said, like, you've blown your chances. You'll never have a child. And I was like, okay. And then...
She came.
Eight pregnancy tests later, and my ex-husband came in and he's like, what? I said, wow. And it was, yeah, so she's a proper little miracle. So, you know, she can do no wrong in my eyes.
Yeah.
And she's so well behaved. You know, it's like absolutely fabulous.
Yeah, so she's got you a little sappy.
She's the sappy, yeah. And I'm a Dina going, sweetie, come on, let's go. She's like, oh gosh, mum, really?
I love it. But there is something about your children seeing you beyond anything else. I think it's the most humbling thing. I think you can go off and do these amazing things and you come home and they pee on you. And there's something wonderful about that, right?
Exactly.
Because you're like, but you know what? This is what it's about. And they love you because of you. And I wonder if some ways, and we'll get on to your struggles, because again, you've been through a lot, but I think...
I don't do anything by...
You don't do anything by... it seems to me that there is that consistency there, which was the love and respect you had for each other. And I think that's a big thing. I know we say, you know, to throw the word around as well, but I think a child that feels respected, there's something... And when you speak about it, there is that you kind of see her for, you know, not just she's your kid, but you like her as an individual.
Yeah,
she's beautiful.
She's a great person, and she's got... And even the friends she surrounds her... She's got surrounded by, you know, she's making good choices. And I've always said, I'm not going to interfere. Whatever you do, that's your choice. I'll always be here 24/7, whatever you need. But, you know, I just want her to be herself. And so far, she's rocking it.
Amazing, amazing, amazing.
And you know what the best thing is? She's so much taller than me, and her feet are bigger than mine. So now she can't even nick my clothes or my trainers. I win.
Yeah, we've got that with my daughter. But I do that thing where I divide everything by two. If I want something expensive, I'm like, actually, it's half the price because we'll both wear it.
Yeah, I can't do that anymore. I can't do that anymore because nothing fits her. She was like, Mum, you just dress like a small child.
Oh, that's so cute.
And she's like, yeah, trainers are bigger. Everything's bigger than mine.
I love it. So talk me through, again, because like you said, it's been well documented, but your history around sort of battling mental health issues. When do you first know? So anorexia, was that sort of the first thing that you feel sort of went on your radar when you just felt unsettled, that you didn't feel...
I think so. It's really hard to pinpoint because I'm writing a book at the moment, and I was trying to sort of figure out where it all stemmed from. And I think if you think about it too much, it's not a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to go too far back. But I always felt a little bit different, a little bit awkward. And when I was a teenager, I'd either overeat or then I'd just stop eating. And everything didn't feel quite right. I didn't feel like I fitted in anywhere. And then, as the older I got, and then I moved to London to go to study film. And I did the studenty thing, started, you know, smoking marijuana and Yeah. Well, as you know, everyone knows it anyway, because I've written about it before, and doing things that I shouldn't be doing and just completely going off the wall. Mm. And I don't know what happened. And I just wanted to be in control of things. But in fact, that's so contradictory, because I was not eating, but then taking drugs and not knowing what was happening, sort of thing. So like ecstasy and stuff like that when I was about 19, 20, I think. And so it's kind of like a control all day, every day, study, weekend, don't know what's happening, and go completely nuts.
So again,
nuts.
Very much that sort of polarized, right?
Yeah.
So black or white thing, which again happens with your mood as well, doesn't it? It's kind of interesting that the way you conceptualize the world is that all or nothing.
No, exactly.
I'm being super good or super bad. I'm super good. And so that you kind of spot that. That's interesting. So early on with the food, early on with the drugs. But your life at that point is okay. So you're still at college, you're still school, and it's okay.
I'm
you're
still studying like crazy, but still managing. I don't know. I felt like when I got to my 20s and I was at college, I was literally skimming it. Just, you know, I went AWOL. I went to Manchester for a weekend and I was there for a month. And my tutor phoned me up and said, if you don't get back here with your film, you're going to fail. Mm. So I just went out to a rave and filmed it and then wrote a documentary around this rave culture. And I got like a honours.
Oh my gosh.
I don't even remember doing it. Yeah. I was just like, yeah, just film it. It's fine. It's all good. And they were going, that's amazing. How did you learn so much? I was like, I did it one night. I don't know. I was off my head. So yeah, it sort of went from one extreme to another. And then obviously now I'm a mum and I'm grown up. Well, I'm not grown up, but I'm a mum. But I always did one thing. I still have my bad days and good days. Honey wanted to get the train to her dad's on Sunday. And she's 16, like we said. And she's like, Mum, it's 40 minutes to my dad's house. It's one straight train ride. Can I please let me do it on my own? All my friends do it. And I was like, I don't think I can do this. She's like, Mum, I'm 16, for goodness sake. What were you doing when you were 16? I went, exactly. That's probably why
I'm
doing
it. That's
the point. That's the point. Do you see where I'm coming from? So yeah, she went off on the train and I howled. And I stayed in Victoria at the station. I didn't leave in case she phoned to say, do you know what, I'm not happy. And then I get on the next train and get off at East Croydon and off. I couldn't leave. And so by the time she got home, she's like, Mum, I'm back home, I'm with Dad, it's all cool. And she's like, are you still at the station? Because she could hear the ding-dong, the next train to Brighton. And I was like, yeah. She went, oh my God, Mum, you're crazy. And I said, I was just so worried that, you know, if you I was on the tube and then you needed me. She's like, I'm 16, Mum. I could move, I could go on holiday on my own. I could move into a flat. I went, no, it's never going to happen again. I said, no. I said, I'm really sorry, but this is never going to happen again. I'm coming with you on the train. She's like, but Mum, it takes you all that time. Then you come all, I said, I don't care. I've never been so stressed in my entire life.
So how do you, though, speak to her about, how do you check in on her heart, as it were? Because that's a big one as well, right? They're going through their teen years and you've had all this experience. You've had the lows, you had real lows, you had the highs, how do you articulate that? Are you the kind of parent that speaks openly? Do you wait for her to come to you? How does it work?
I speak openly about everything, to the extent where she just goes, oh, please, Mum, no. It's like boyfriends, you know, we talk about everything. I've told her everything about, you know, Mum went bonkers on drugs. So if anyone ever offers you anything, you come to me and we'll, you know, discuss it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, obviously I don't want you to be doing anything. I said, because it was different in the 90s. She's like, oh, everything was different then, Mum. And I said, and in the 80s. She's like, yeah. But I said, no, but talk to me about anything. Mm-hmm. I said, don't be embarrassed, you know, because obviously it's different between her dad's very, very protective. Mm-hmm. And I think he would love her to be a wee girl forever. And I would too, but I know she's growing up. So I just feel that I've made so many mistakes and I'm not dead yet. So I must have done something right. So I just think if I can say to her, right, don't do this, don't do that, but it's your choice. But ideally, I don't want you to do it. But I think, like I say, it's very ab fab. I think she's learned from my mistakes.
Yeah.
And I always say to her, if you take drugs, your hair will fall out. No, I don't really.
I love that. But how is it, though, being in the public eye where she can look at it and read about it and kind of come back to you on that? So I think that's an interesting thing, isn't it? So, you know, as a parent, you're able, I guess maybe, like, I'm asking this question now in the time of social media where none of us have privacy. I think in a few years, you know, our kids will be able to get with everyone,
isn't it? Because, like, when we were young, you could go out and you could misbehave, or you could do everything. Well, you probably didn't, but I. But you know that you could go back home and nobody knew, and your friends didn't know where you'd been. But now, you literally, you can get in a taxi in Kensington High Street and someone will snap you, and it will be spotted Linda getting in taxi on for what reason? Yeah. But also it means that it means that I behave now. And also I'm too old and I've got Netflix.
God, who?
Yeah,
God,
I mean,
Netflix,
come on. Yeah, I don't need to go out. I've got a cat, I've got Netflix, I've got a 16-year-old. I'm done with all the partying. Well, I do like my gay clubs. Apart from that.
What do you do at the gay clubs?
It's so cool.
Do you sing in the gay
clubs? No, I don't sing. I just like hang out.
Hang out? Oh, just have fun. I'm like, oh, amazing.
Yeah, you just go and dance to Kylie and stuff.
Oh, amazing. I love it. But who is your rock then now? Who, in those moments when you are low, what do you have around you that kind of
See, that's where I struggle. I don't really have anyone that I think. There's nights when I have, if I've not got Honey and I'm starting to feel anxious, I literally will go through my phone, and I do. It's, I don't know if it's to do with my the way that my brain's tuned, because I know who's in the phone, and I know that it's not one of those people that I will actually go, oh, do you know what, I'm really struggling, and I'll look through the names, and I'll look through the names, I'll look through the names, and then I'll go, Sopranos, I'll watch The Sopranos, or I'll put something on that makes me laugh, like Vice Principals. I'll have to put something on the telly that will make me laugh, and then even the cat, I'm like, Pickles. She's like, I'm just doing my own thing.
Is that kind of self-sufficiency always been a thing for you?
Yeah, I think so. I think I've trusted quite a lot of people and then they've let me down, or, you know, just weird things. Like, also, I don't plan things with people, because someone asked me to go out, I think it was a couple of days back, and I phoned out and I said, I can't come for lunch because I've just been offered a job. She's like, well, cancel it. And I said, well, I can't, because it's work and it's money and, you know, I kind of struggle at the moment. So she's like, oh, well, you promised lunch. And I was like, yeah, but this is work. I work freelance. So you've got
to
say, And so then when people talk to me like that, I start to withdraw again. And so I just don't go out. So I don't organise anything. So what I do is, like, there's a big cabaret in Soho, which I can't wait to go and see. I've seen it before. So I buy one ticket because I think I don't want to ask anyone. And then people go, why didn't you ask me? Why didn't you ask me? Because I think, so, what if I can't make it? And then you'll go, but you've bought tickets. I stress about things like that. Very weird. Is that weird?
Well, do you know what? I think there's a saying in psychology that past performance predicts future behavior. And I think, think about how, kind of when we go through the world, we try and figure it out based on what's happened in the past, right? Which is why when you've had a bad pizza, you avoid all Italian food. Now, Italian food's great, but you had that bad pizza.
You had that bad time. Yeah.
And that, you know, that's always going to, so if what you're saying is every time, or at least it feels, because obviously it's not every time, I'm sure you've trusted people that have been there for you, but what's paramount in your mind at the time?
I'm the sort of person that as much as I will never fall out with someone, it will stick in my head.
Sticks in your head.
And then so when you talked about the pizza, we ordered a pizza from this place in West Hampstead, and they delivered it, and I had a hair in it, and so I took it back and I said, look, there's a hair in the pizza. And they went, well, that wasn't us. And I went, are you serious? You think that was me? I'm bald. Are you crazy?
That's ridiculous.
And they were trying to argue with me, and there's a big black hair in it. And I was like, all I wanted to do was change it. So there, I'm never going back
to that pizza.
Never going back there. Yeah, my hair, are you crazy?
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But there is something about it, and I think, you know, again, I think what we tend to do is we use things like humor instead of anger. Yeah. You know what I mean? So it's just easier to laugh at it or to displace it.
I do that all the time.
I can see, that's clear. And then you're very funny, so it works. I'm sure you make it okay for everyone else around you.
Yeah.
People must be great. Okay, we can move on and talk about, you know, funny.
I'm always the fun two person to ask out.
And then the moment that you're not feeling great, then that
I just don't answer the phone.
Then that's kind of worrying, though, because that, I mean, I don't think any of us were made to not have, we're social creatures, right? None of us were made to kind of be islands and I think we live in really lonely times, you know, it's this cliche, so connected yet not in the same way.
No, because I keep saying, I said to Honey the other day, and I said, oh, it'd be quite nice to get married or something. She went, where did that come from? I mean, I said, I'm just a bit lonely. Yeah. And I was chatting away to the cat while Honey was like coming out the shower, and she's like, Mum, are you talking to the cat? And I was like, yeah. She went, you don't do that when you're on your own, do you? I do. I was like, Pickles, where are you going? What are you doing? Cat's like that. It's like, I just want to talk, you know? Yeah. And also being freelance,
Yeah, well, that's so, the other thing. Yeah.
So people have got normal jobs and they're sort of interacting with people 24/7, whereas I'll just speak to strangers in the street, which is fine because I've got two martial art backgrounds.
Fine, but so there you go.
So they can't harass me.
It can stop there.
I will punch them. But
I had a friend who is a magazine editor, and she's a magazine editor now, but when she freelanced, she'd organize Christmas parties for just like random people that freelance because it was great because like the Christmas party's a wonderful thing, right?
Yeah.
And she's like, just like, yeah, random. I was like, oh, count me in. Sounds good.
Yeah, no, exactly. Well, it's difficult because I think as much as you probably get grumpy working with the same people every single day, you've got a routine.
That family,
And it's a bit like a family. Yeah. And sometimes, I mean, I don't get me wrong, I absolutely love doing whatever it is I'm doing. Someone said to me the other day, what's that you do? And I went, I've actually no idea. I don't know. I've just been winging it for years. I'm not sure.
But do you know what? On that note as well, I wanted to pick up with you because I think there's something about who you become known for in the media. I think we all become a bit of a caricature of something. But I think in your case, and we chatted about this in a green room, I think a while back, this idea that when, you know, because you've been open about your issues, you're always called on when it comes to mental health or hair loss. And does that ever annoy you?
Yes, it does, actually, to be honest with you. I don't mind it because obviously if it helps other people, that's great. But it also makes me feel that I've spent 48 years on this planet and I'm only good at talking about being crazy or having no hair. And I've got no other, you know, I didn't, you know, didn't present Top of the Pops for 5 years. I'm not a mother. You know, I don't do stand-up comedy. I've not written a book. It's just basically the go-to person to what you want to do. How do you deal with your hair loss? And, you know, how do you deal with bipolar or whatever it is I've got? I don't know. People tell me I've got all sorts of, I don't even go to the doctors anymore. I don't care. So I just know that I get very confused and get stuck in my ways and get very... I'm either extremely happy or very frustrated or can't leave the house.
You just feel feelings very intensely.
Yeah, very intense, like literally.
But that, you know, that to me is really interesting because you're right. I think it's wonderful that we live in a day and age where we can talk about mental health and that's great. Yeah. But at the same time, you know, absolutely, your identity is so much more diverse than that. And I think when you have a public profile, it's almost as if you don't get to choose what it is. You're the athlete, the politician, you know, the woman.
I'm sure you must have the same. Everyone must come to you with problems.
Yeah.
Well, and you just say, yeah, it's like my friend's a doctor.
Yeah.
Excuse me, what do you think this is? You know, on a night out.
Yeah, yeah.
Why don't it's an ulcer on your tongue? Don't stick your tongue next to me. We're having dinner. What are you doing? I think I've got piles. Really, not over dinner. But you know, it's like everyone just associates certain things with certain people.
Yeah. But I wonder whether that kind of feeds into the way that we see ourselves, right? And I think, again, kind of going back to when you speak, you know, about whether it's Honey and you light up, or even sort of those moments when you were speaking about your mom, and I know you lost her, didn't you?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
But I think these are the people that see us in a completely different way. Maybe that's the liberation, that's what happens.
Yeah, I think my mom had a problem with my hair loss. She used to put her hand over my forehead, and then she'd go, oh, there you are. There's my Gail back. She just could not accept the fact I was bald. And it was fine because we did a documentary for the BBC about alopecia and it was about a month after I'd lost my hair. So it's pretty full on. There was lots of tears and all the rest of it. And actually, my mum didn't open up to me and I didn't watch the documentary back for quite a long time because I was still finding it all very difficult. Just getting through every day was great. And I watched it back and she was in my kitchen. Well, my kitchen, as in when I grew up, in my home in Edinburgh, because she still lived in there until she died. And it was the first time I actually saw her slightly break down and just... For me, she was always like, oh, that's another thing, Gail. Oh, you know, it was always like I'd done something wrong. Mm-hmm. And then when she was chatting away to the director, she just went, oh, I just feel for her. It's just one thing after another. And she was like, I feel so sad. Never said that to me. Yeah. And I watched it back after she died. So I'm like, you could have just told me. It would be fine.
But why do you think she didn't?
Because she's Scottish. That's what we do. We just go, Because I remember when I took her in, when she was going for chemotherapy, and I was bald and she still had her hair. And an elderly nurse came up and took me by the hand. She's like, come on, dear, I'll put you to bed. And I was like, no, she's the one that's dying. I'm just bald. She thought I was the one. And my mum's like, right, I'll be off then. I was like, no, you're going to the bed. They're trying to give me chemotherapy. And I thought, yeah, whatever. But yeah, I think she was very stoic.
Yeah.
And, you know, mum and dad were not the best at showing emotions. So I remember that one day that me and my brother got home from school and mum and dad were cuddling on the sofa and both of us instantly panicked and were like, is someone dying?
Because you guys are being nice to each other.
Yeah, it was like literally, oh my gosh, somebody's dead. What's happened? Is it grandma? Is it grandpa? And they're like, no, we're just being affectionate. We're going, why? What? You know, they wouldn't cuddle us. They wouldn't, no one touched each other. We were like MC Hammer House. Don't touch us.
I love it.
Yeah,
it is a funny thing, that stoicism, though. It's as if I name it somehow, it won't be something that I can manage. And I think there's like a sweet point, though, as well, though. I think there's something about, and I don't know, I, as a psychologist, I think one of the things I worry about is that we went from not talking about problems at all to now identifying everything as a problem. And actually, you know, there's this place where in between where absolutely you should clock it and seek support, but also, you know, understand that resilience comes from doing stuff you didn't think you could do and facing it and from doing, you know,
and pushing
and actually not naming
everyone's got something at the moment. And I think it seems to be the easy way. You know, I kind of like, I know when I'm good and I know when I'm bad, but I don't label myself.
Yeah.
But everyone's really quick to label each other and go, well, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this, I've got this. And sometimes I feel like it's a little bit of a scapegoat for people that maybe have just behaved in a bad way and they go, oh, it's because I've got this.
Well, and I think that's a really interesting point you raised, because labeling is really, look, I think there's definitely a place for it. I mean, I've worked with women that thought they were just evil until they were diagnosed as having postnatal depression. And you're not evil, you just have an illness that means that you can have, and that's great. But then I think on the other hand, if you upset me and I call you a bully and I label you that, when you inadvertently upset me, or if I'm over, then I think that's really unfair. So again, labels are really interesting as well. I could speak to you forever. We do this thing on this podcast where we kind of ask everybody for a moment, a comfort, and a challenge. So moment,
like a game show thing.
It is like but I think sort of psychologically, to me, moments are those things that the kind of are life changing, right? So when you realize that you've seen something in a different way, whether it's about yourself or about the world. The comfort is what's your go-to thing.
Okay.
And then the challenge, well, I can't call it a challenge, I think it's more of a compass. Where are you going in the future? What do you hope for? So let's start with the moment. Where was that kind of seminal moment in your life where you kind of really learned about you or about life?
I probably would say the same as most mothers. It's like the first time I ever saw honey. And I was like, wow, I've kind of starved myself, I've cut myself, I've done everything really bad, I've been on self-destruct, and then suddenly there's this tiny little person, and they're like, that's what I was made to be here for. So yeah, and I remember going, when I was pregnant, she's going to be called Pebbles. And I can remember my in-laws were going, no, you're not calling her Pebbles. I went, I'm carrying her. I'll call her what I want. And my mum was just like, let her go. Just let her do what she wants, because you're going to do it anyway. And so I was like, Pebbles, Pebbles, Pebbles. Talk to her every night. Pebbles, Pebbles, Pebbles. She came out and I went, she's called Honey. And everyone's like, is she called Honey now or what? And I was like, no, she's Honey. She's Honey. And she literally, she was 9 pounds, well, 8 pounds, 12. She's a big girl. She didn't really cry or anything. They had to smack her bottom and she kind of went, meh. And then, but she had these massive eyes and she just looked at me and I was like, oh, I've given birth to a toddler. I don't know if it was the gas in air and all the drugs I was on, but I was like, I've just given birth to a toddler. And then I had to be taken off to have surgery straight away. And I just remember she was just smiling away at me. And it was a proper change of life. I was like, right, this is my focus.
Beautiful. And tell me about your comforts in those moments that are dark. What do you do? What gets you out of it?
Dark moments. Well, I used to listen to really sad to music. Why do people do that? You know, when you go, oh, I'm having a really bad day, I'm going to listen to Radiohead because that's going to work. Sad moments, I tend to go have a go-to movie. So I will watch like Anchorman, something stupid, where you can quote it. Or I'll go to Star Wars and it'll remind me of being 7 or 8. And then, or if it's winter time, I go to Hyde Park and I go on roller coasters. Or I will go to anything that's got noise, and just I need noise. I can't be on my own.
So it's kind of a distraction. So it's part of the distraction to kind of...
Because I think about things 24/7. So I go to bed and I think, right, don't think about things. And then my brain's going, well, do you remember the Beano comic?
Yeah.
The numbskulls. They live upstairs in my head. And they're all chatting to each other and like, no, don't do this. And I feel crazy sometimes because I was like, right, don't think about that. Oh, no, but what... Did I switch that off? Yes, I definitely did. Now, should I go down? I'm hungry. I'm not even sure. Should I put the telly on? Oh, I think Snapped Women Who Kills on the Crime Channel. Let's watch that, because that's a really good idea at 1 o'clock in the morning. So, it just doesn't stop. It is. Noise.
So you're just about kind of... Because it is. It's this idea of when you feel that your thoughts control you more rather than the other way around, and kind of learning how to... Have you ever tried mindfulness, meditation, any of that stuff?
I can't do it. I've been to so many... I've been to India.
I can't. You know, there's a section of... I was reading a study the other day about some people actually find, while it works, and there's a lot of studies that it's wonderful for the vast majority of people, but for a small minority, mindfulness and meditation actually can make things worse because it's about... They think more.
I was ill when I was doing mindfulness, mm-hmm. and because we were sitting in a room for an hour and everyone was really calm and everything. And so I start thinking, going, oh, I wonder if he's a serial killer. When I get home, oh, I wonder what's happening there. And my brain just doesn't, it gets worse and worse and worse. Yeah. So I just need noise around me. Yeah. And I know that certain things work for certain people.
Sure.
So me, it's kind of like either headphones on or dancing around the room or
moving, right? Does exercise work?
Running.
That's a brilliant one.
I sound like Beyonce there, didn't I? But so anything like that. I know that I will always watch Vice Principals. If you've never seen it, please watch
Vice Principals. I must have.
It is hilarious. Have you seen,
is it a movie or a series?
No, it's a series. It's two series, and it's just so funny. It's so wrong and bad, but it's really, really funny. Brilliant. I think you'd like it. It's great. And I can watch it over and over.
And it kind of...
Yeah. And then also I start thinking, I wish I could write things like that.
Well, maybe you can, which brings us nicely to our last thing. What is on for the future? What is a goal that you've set yourself? Where are you orientating your life towards now going forward?
Well, because it's coming up to the new year. And I know that I never usually make any sort of resolutions because I don't really see the point because, you know, you're never going to keep them. But this year I'm feeling... Yeah, I've had an okay year. I was bankrupt last year. I was homeless the year before. And it was just one thing after another. And I've been more and more positive. So I'm training as a personal trainer, just as a sideline thing. I'm writing a book, which I'm actually really happy with. And I'm not rushing it, even though everyone's like, right, we need to get out by this time. That you know what it's like, because you've got a few, haven't you? Yeah. Quite a few. And whereas I think this is like my baby.
Mm.
And I'm not a writer, but I want it to be perfect. So I'm not rushing it for anyone. Good. And I will end it at some point. And I've got two different publishers that were, well, definite. So, you know, I'm not stressing about that. So I know that that's coming. And I don't know. I just need to keep on top of things, to be honest with you, and stop doing, you know, I tend to do lots of... jobs that I don't really want to do. Mm. I was supposed to do a certain program this morning and I wasn't supposed to. They asked me yesterday if I'd go in and talk about something that I didn't believe in. And I said, well, I don't believe in it. They went, yeah, but just, you know, make something up. I was just like, no, I'm actually not doing it. I'm not getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. Mm. And they said, oh, just pretend that you believe in this and just come up with an opinion. And you just think, and just, so many times I've done it. And then you come away and you just think, is that all I'm worth? Am I just like nothing? Am I just sort of a face and they just want me to talk about stuff that I don't really believe in? So yeah, I'm going to do positive things and not do stuff just because someone tells me to, because I get very nervous as well. And I think if I say no, people are going to think badly of me.
Yeah.
As opposed to, you know, I think if I'm a yes person, then everyone's going to love you. But it's not the case at all. Because then you just end up getting used.
Absolutely.
But and also I'm starting to learn this. It's only taken me like how many years?
No,
I'm almost 50. I've just got it.
Yeah, but you know, there's something about, you know, people talk about self-esteem like it's something that you should just be like, yeah, I'm great and you feel good. But self-esteem comes, I think, for more than anything else, about an integrity between what you feel and what you do.
Yeah.
You know, that congruence. And you're absolutely right. If you're talking about stuff or minimizing stuff, and, you know, and just as a little bit of, you know, kind of just speaking to you now, I think, you know, it's a joy to speak to you, but it's clear that you take care of people. I feel you've kind of taken care of me here. Every time things have gotten dark, you kind of make a joke and you laugh and you, so maybe it's just about recognizing that there's a reciprocity there. There's people that, you know, there's good people out there too that'll do that.
Yeah, well, you know, I've met so many brilliant people this year and, people that I really respect and nice people. I mean, I've met nice people for years and years, but I think the older you get and watching my daughter growing up, I'm just thinking, you can't grow up, you can't grow away. And so you sort of, you really focus on relationships with people that you respect and you mm-hmm. love, because they're going to be the ones that you're going to need. Mm-hmm. And they're going to need me at some point as well. Well, everyone needs each other.
Well, of course.
But you need the right people.
Yeah.
You don't just want to go to anybody. Yeah. And, you know.
And you don't need 100 of them. You need 2 or 3 people to get you through life.
Just
and
one will be good.
Yeah.
I mean, the cat is so bored. The cat is like, literally, I walk in, she's like, oh God, she's back again. So anyway, Pickles, what I did today was I had this podcast with Linda, right?
And then Linda said, two-way traffic, Pickles.
And then I tried twice, okay? And then the cat's just like, whatever.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure,
Thank
Gail.
You so much
and I can't wait to read
me.
The book. No, it's been great. And where can people connect with you or learn more about what you're doing?
Oh, well, basically at the moment I'm on, well, Twitter, it's just mm-hmm. Gail Porter. I am Gail Porter. Yeah, it's just Gail Porter. And then Instagram, I am Gail Porter. And there is a Facebook of me, but all I know is it's got me wearing a black dress on it, because I don't really go on Facebook very much, because there's about 25 of me. And mm-hmm. I don't know why people do that. Why do they want to be somebody else? It's very bizarre. So I'm kind of scared of Facebook. And also I don't want to see people's pictures of, oh, look at my fiance. Oh, look how happy I am. Oh, whatever. I don't care. Go on Twitter and just like, so I can block you really easily.
Amazing. So if you want Gail to block you on Twitter, it's Gail Porter.
Yeah, just go on Gail Porter and I'll chat away to anybody. And also I'm awake all night, so I'm sort of available 24 hours a day if you want to chat. And so that's that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you
so
much.
Such a pleasure.
Can I move in?
Yeah, anytime.
Oh, brilliant.
Fabulous. I've really enjoyed speaking to Gail. And, you know, I think the way that she's speaking about orientating herself in the new year, I think that's what we all need to do, right? It's about kind of setting those goals, setting those things to look forward to and working through them. And I wish her all the best. That was such a great chat. In fact, that was our last chat for 2018. We will definitely be back in January, though. And we've got a great lineup of people who are going to come in and speak on the psychology behind. So please make sure you join us. And you know, we'll let you know when these things are out, when all the podcasts are out. All you need to do is subscribe if you haven't done so already. And as always, love to hear from you about different ideas or people that you think that I should speak to. So do get in contact with me. And until then, I wish you a very healthy, happy body and mind, and a very healthy, happy new year too.